This is Nick Wright of geopoliticalmonitor.com with Zachary Fillingham, managing editor. And today we're going to talk about China's naval modernization. So Zach, perhaps you could start by just giving us a little bit of context about China's development militarily, what it's been doing over the last number of years, and how its naval development and modernization fits into that broader scheme.
Okay, so basically this is an issue that is increasingly on the front burner for U.S. military planners as they develop their own sort of fleet composition strategy as well as tactics with regards to China. To make a long story short, over the last decade, China's Navy has improved dramatically in terms of its quantity and its quality. China has been unrolling new ships very quickly at a very quick pace. Just for example, between 2014 and 2018, China launched more submarines, warships, amphibious vessels, and auxiliaries than the total number of ships serving in the individual navies of Germany, India, Spain, and the United Kingdom. That's just within 4 years. So, it's getting to the point where by number of ships, it is roughly equivalent to the U.S. Navy. However, a better metric to focus on for gauging the size of a navy is its tonnage. And in that sense, the U.S. Navy is still far larger than the PLA Navy, mostly because the U.S. Navy, as we know, is running about 10 huge supercarriers around the world. And China right now, it only has one that's operational, the one that it bought from Ukraine and refitted, the Liaoning. It has another that is domestically built based on the Liaoning's design, and that's in its early testing phase. And there are rumors that it's building its third, and it will probably get to about five or six within maybe the next decade. So in quantitative terms, there's been an expansion, and also in qualitative terms, the quality of the PLA Navy boats has been dramatically improving. According to one study by RAND, over 70% of the PLA Navy fleet in 2017 was considered modern by RAND standards. That number was 50% in 2010. So there too, we see a very quick improvement, a very recent and dramatic improvement in the quality of the PLA.
Exactly. The expansion of the Navy, is that reflective of China's military expansion more broadly, or is it focusing specifically on naval development over other areas?
It's focused specifically on the Navy as well as the Air Force. China has historically been a land power. It is focused very little on maritime issues. That has changed in the modern context, mostly after there was an incident in 1995 when Taiwan's first democratic elections, there were presidential elections. There was an incident whereby the Chinese government fired missiles to as a sort of way to intimidate the Taiwanese authorities. And in response, Bill Clinton dispatched two American carrier groups to the Taiwan Strait to sort of emphasize the ongoing U.S. military commitment to Taiwan. After that, Chinese military planners recalibrated their strategy towards controlling the seas off the coast of China and developing a missile and air capacity to not necessarily fight and win a war with the United States, but to deny the United States military free rein in the areas surrounding China.
Interesting. So is the expansion of the Chinese military more broadly also going on, or is it an emphasis now on the Navy?
It's Navy. It continues to be Navy. Actually, the Army itself has been scaling back. The PLA, the People's Liberation Army, has generally been a large force reflective of China's relatively large population historically been a large force. It has been scaling back its size and becoming more professionalized. And with those budgetary savings, that budget has been rerouted towards the Navy and to a lesser degree, the Air Force. This has also been happening against the backdrop of just general increases in Chinese military spending on a year-on-year basis. The numbers are never totally clear how much money is being spent, but rough estimates are that China is now maybe at roughly a third of U.S. military.
And can you give us some background on the geopolitics of the region historically and in present, and how China's expanded Navy and military might impact that balance of power moving forwards?
Okay, so post-World War II in the Pacific, basically ever since the Battle of Midway, the United States has had free rein over the open waters of the Pacific Ocean. And the U.S. Navy has been able to operate freely and without threat. So fast forward to now, this is pretty much for the first time that that's superiority is being challenged. Obviously, it's not just the United States, it's the United States and its allies, mainly Japan, to a lesser degree, South Korea, and also the on-again, off-again, Quad allies, Australia, and maybe India. Well, no, let's not talk about India. So basically, that core alliance is being, the superiority, quantitative and qualitative, of that core alliance is now being challenged by the rise of the PLA Navy. So from the American point of view, China's naval modernization is challenging its preponderance in the Pacific, and it's working to reverse that trend however it can, by technology or by basically doubling down on its own fleet size, adopting new technologies and trying to improve relationships with key allies in the region, however hard that is in the Trump era. From the Chinese point of view, this military modernization is just reflective of its own legitimate interests in the area. Basically, those legitimate interests are to to be able to operate in its littoral seas, the seas close to it, in its near abroad, and deny access to the United States Navy in a repeat of the type of situation that we saw in 1995. So the key thing here to consider is that China's legitimate interests include some things that are considered illegitimate to other states in the region. Specifically, the South China Sea, as we know, we've discussed in depth on the Geopolitical Monitor. The South China Sea is a complex territorial dispute where China claims mostly all of it, all of the islands in the South China Sea, and by extension, the waters of the South China Sea. And these claims run contrary to claims from Vietnam, Philippines, Malaysia, and Taiwan. So there, and then all of those countries have different presences on the archipelago, and that's a complex situation. According to Beijing, those seas are its core territorial waters. It has recently upgraded the South China Sea to a quote-unquote core interest, which puts it on the level of territorial integrity of Tibet and Taiwan, which is pretty much as high as you can go as far as a strategy. So basically this naval modernization is just to ensure that it can ensure its own core interests with regard to the South China Sea, and also with regard to Taiwan, which, as we know, is a self-governing democratic island that China claims, but is de facto independent, if not de jure, and is also, a roundabout U.S. ally in the sense that the United States government is by law required to defend Taiwan in the event of a war under the Taiwan Relations Act. So in a way, I mean, China's modernizing its military and just trying to come into its own as a regional and increasingly global power. However, there are these two issues that can still draw it into conflict with the United States, which, as we know, has had global interests for the last 60 years and continues to have global interests with regards to...
And the other regional powers, have they responded to China's increased naval presence with expanding their own? Is this reflective of a significant change in the balance of power or simply increased militarization?
I think that, so to answer the first question, countries have been responding with their own military modernization programs and expansion programs to various degrees, depending on their own capacity. Good examples would be Vietnam, which is probably the most important rival claimant with regards to the South China Sea, has a historically sort of antagonistic relationship with China, sort of culturally and historically at times. Through, you know, this is ancient history. But so Vietnam has been trying to modernize its own navy. Obviously, this happens to a much, much smaller degree. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the budget of the Vietnamese military is something in the tens of billions compared to China's, which is approaching 200. Japan is also working to modernize its military, and it too is focusing on its navy. Sorry, what was the second question?
Are other countries responding in a way that will stave off Chinese hegemony in the naval realm?
So we do have a situation where there's a sort of conventional arms race unfolding in East Asia. So you have basically everybody's responding to their own way to this expansion in Chinese naval power. And you know, sometimes these issues happen in such a way that it's kind of hard to see their import as they're happening, right? But over the last decade or so, I would say, probably even the last 5 years, we've seen some pretty pretty consequential changes in the Asian security fabric with regards to a transition away from over-reliance on the U.S.-based treaty system and a movement towards a more balanced approach by some of the countries in the region that are obviously they're geographically closer to China than they are the United States, and they're increasingly more economically bound to China than they are the United States. So they need to hedge their bets because even though China's emerging as the de facto military power of Asia, and that might be threatening to a country like Vietnam. Vietnam still borders China and is still economically engaged with China, so it needs to live with China, right? So you have a bit of a balancing act going on with all of these countries to various degrees. For example, Vietnam is kind of on the antagonistic end of the spectrum, where it's still trying to expand its military, get as close as it can to the United States. You know, it was an eager participant of the TPP, for example. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the Philippines under the Duterte government, which has been swinging more closely to China, although it still keeps the U.S. its historical closeness to the U.S. as an option, as it situates itself in a sort of triangular relationship between the two powers, if that makes sense. So all of these countries need to navigate a new normal of China now too big to ignore. You need to make peace with China's rise, and the United States, which obviously still militarily is the unrivaled hegemon in the world for the time being, economically less so. But obviously U.S. power is in decline in Asia. And obviously from the Trump administration, U.S., and this is arguably more important, U.S. political and diplomatic will to remain involved in Asia is also in decline.
And Zach, you've talked about China's desire to prevent the U.S. from intervening in regional affairs or to lessen their ability to do so, and also for China to attempt to assert what it sees as being its historical claims, historical legitimate claims from China's perspective. What about ambitions beyond those traditional claims? Does China have any possible interest in expanding its territory or expanding its military influence outside of the region?
I don't think there is anything at this time that you could point to. However, if you sort of look back at the arc of history, as countries develop global interests, global economic interests, whether these are imperial systems or more recently free trade systems, there's always globe straddling security interests that come with them. For example, I mean, you could argue that, there's going to be situations in the world, in far-flung lands, where China is going to have a security imperative to secure this or that resource, key strategic resource, or ensure the survival of this or that, key ally. We've seen it, obviously, over the last 20 years or so with the United States and its unipolar moment. We saw it throughout the Cold War with the sort of global interests of the two empires. So I think that although there's nothing you can point to right now and say, oh, this it's going to be that, it's inevitable that this happens. Like, for example, Belt and Road, China's pouring money into Belt and Road, $3 trillion or whatever the official figure is. It's always hard to know exactly how much because the stated figure and the actual figure always diverge. But so they spend this incredible amount of money on Belt and Road. And what if you have a situation where all of these or a large part of these investments are threatened by some sort of political development in one of these countries, or there's a threat of expropriation or, the many things that could possibly happen? You might find this newly empowered, newly capable PLA military, being dispatched to far off lands in the future to protect China's economic interests.
Interesting. And could you elaborate a little bit about what the traditional claims are outside of the South China Sea, where we'll likely see China making claims in the short term, and then perhaps elaborate if there are any additional international interests, perhaps Africa or other regions where China's putting a lot of money and investment into, and give your thoughts on whether or not those will be impacted by China's military expansion in years to come.
Well, the most important ones are, like, in China's near abroad, are South China Sea, which it will not, like, the CCP has staked too much sort of political capital to ever back down on. It is a core issue that they will not quote-unquote give an inch of their rightful land, or whatever Xi Jinping recently said. And then there's Taiwan, which is obviously well-established territorial dispute that is not going anywhere. And then there is the Senkaku/Diaoyu Islands with Japan, which has been on the back burner for the last couple of years. There was a time a couple of years ago where all these things were happening at the same time, and I think the Chinese government kind of made a decision to kind of let that one, just put that one aside for now, because it's better to sort of focus on if these are going to be antagonistic, tense, standoffs and conflicts over territory, it's better to go one at a time. So it's been focusing on the South China Sea, and it's been, you know, making great strides in solidifying its claim in the South China Sea by basically militarizing its holdings, and by slicing off the opposing claims one by one, basically through Asian, the Southeast Asia grouping. It's been able to sort of break the solidarity of the opposing bloc of all these other smaller countries with their own claims through financial inducements, etc. And so those are the important ones. Those are the immediate ones. Obviously, there are Himalayan, territorial disputes with India in the Himalayas. We saw one flare up a couple years ago in the Doklam Plateau, where there was a sort of brief military exchange between the two countries. Obviously, those ones are on the back burner too, but they're not going away. They've eluded resolution for a long time. And sort of more broadly, I mean, like, I think it's difficult to predict. Obviously, energy lines of supply are incredibly important. And most of this, another thing we haven't talked about the naval modernization is China suffers through a major choke point in its energy lines of supply through the Strait of Malacca. So basically around 70% of its energy shipments, its imports, go through this choke point of the Strait of Malacca, where technically if it wasn't able to achieve naval superiority over that area, then the United States would be able to choke off the Chinese economy from its energy lifeblood, oil and gas imports. So there's that. And then, I mean, like, really, you never know. You never know where it could flare up. It could flare up in Pakistan. It could flare up in African countries, because China, as the world's second largest economy, it has global interests, right? And, you know, something we often forget, and I'm not just talking about China, I'm talking about countries all over the world. There are always political and economic interests, right? And there's always elites, political and economic elites. And sometimes these decision-making processes don't unfold in a purely technocratic way, right? You might have leaders of certain large state-owned economic conglomerates that have the ear of certain political elites, and they're able to create an intervention in one situation that affects this conglomerate, where an intervention in another situation that affected a different conglomerate would never happen, right? So it creates a situation where they're impossible to predict, but they are pervasive. They're all over the world because China is, you know, a global power.
Is that previously discussed about China's increasing naval capacity in terms of number of ships and size, but also its technological development? How does Chinese ships, their modern ships that they've been building, compare to the United States and other countries? Are they still behind technologically? Are they fairly close? And what impact will the technological differences have on the effectiveness of the Navy, even if it's of equivalent size to the US in terms of number of ships?
Okay, so yeah, that's a good question. Basically, technologically, China is still regarded as being behind the U.S. Navy. And a good example of this is that their newest submarine class was spotted, basically. So they have all sorts of new ships rolling out all the time, right? So it's hard to test all these ships. It's hard to know how these ships will do in a combat situation, right? And that's another edge that the United States has over China. It's been fighting wars all over the world. So, I mean, like, in a way, one positive byproduct of that, if there are any, is that the U.S. military is more combat ready, having been combat tested, right? So all of these Chinese platforms are rolling out, and their testing and their capabilities are purely hypothetical because they haven't been tested against foreign militaries. Actually, in fact, yeah, a conventional exchange of fire between foreign militaries is extremely rare. I mean, even the American wars, generally incredibly asymmetric affairs. Which also, to go back to a podcast we did a couple weeks ago, that was what made the Kashmir conflict so sort of interesting in a purely academic way. It's the first time in a long time that conventional militaries have clashed, right? So it's the first time in a long time you could actually look at those two aerial platforms, the Su-24 and the F-16s, and say, you know, which one would come out in a fight. So anyway, sorry, I digress. So basically, you have all these advanced platforms rolling out for the Chinese PLA Navy. And one example, it's new, I think, Shang-2 submarine class. So one of its newest submarines was detected by the Japanese Navy off the Diaoyu Islands and basically followed and forced to surface. And it's a blunder on the part of the PLA Navy. Like that submarine was never supposed to be detected. It was something that they obviously were not expecting to happen. So you have a situation where they thought their new submarine was undetectable, but for whatever reason, the technology that the Japanese Navy was running was able to detect it, right? So I bring that up just because it's just to say it's hard outside of combat situations to make those sort of qualitative judgments as to which one's more advanced. But the Chinese Navy undeniably is closing the gap incredibly rapidly. Like the gap is diminishing. And if this current pace were to continue, it's conceivable that the Chinese Navy in sort of quantitative and qualitative terms could exceed the US Navy within maybe even a decade. As I said before, the pace has been frenetic.
And from a political perspective, Zach, in our previous podcast, we talked a bit about and you mentioned previously in this recording that there's not just the military might, but also a change in political will and focus. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the different political parties in power, whether it be the U.S. With President Donald Trump, or whether it be some of the governments in the region, including China. Talk a little bit about the political context. To what extent that's reflective of just the way things happen to be now, which may or may be likely to change over time, and to what extent it's reflective of changing trends and the elected politicians representing those changing trends in terms of policy.
Okay. Well, so, I mean, obviously, all of us in the English-speaking world who follow American politics know that the Trump administration has brought a trend away from global interests, more inward-looking focus, America first, et cetera, et cetera. One of the first things that Donald Trump did was to cancel the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which a lot of these countries that are worried about China's economic and military expansion were counting on as a way to basically guarantee the United States continuing involvement in the region and also give them an economic alternative to over-reliance on the Chinese market. Obviously, the TPP with the United States did not happen. It still exists, and maybe the U.S. will join it in the future. It's hard to say from the United States point of view whether Trump is the exception or the rule. I think that we're going to see that in the future. I mean, like, I think that Trump taps into, this is my personal opinion, I think Trump taps into a certain nativist trend that's going to outlive him. Like, I think that a lot of Americans are questioning the value and utility of this sort of Pax post-Cold War, Pax Americana, globe-straddling interests. However, it's impossible to say whether that will continue. I will say that as America transitions from the post 9/11 focus on terrorism, its military has been sort of calibrated, its military and strategy have been calibrated towards the war on terror for, over 15 years now. That's ending. And what seems to be replacing it is a focus on China as a peer competitor. And if that does sort of remain the focal point of U.S. defense planning, then all of these sort of all of these corresponding diplomatic and economic initiatives will continue, and they'll continue to keep the U.S. involved in East Asia and continue to keep the U.S. attempting to reassure allies whenever possible. Whether or not it will succeed is another question entirely, because from the Chinese perspective, obviously China is a one-party state with the Chinese Communist Party holding all the levers of power. So there's no elections there. There's no public opinion. However, the Chinese Communist Party does find itself beholden to certain political considerations. Mainly, this has become its legitimacy as the, you can say, father of the Chinese nation. The so the CCP obviously does not preside over a socialist system anymore. Socialism, Marxism used to be the legitimizing ideology of China, and by extension, the CCP's monopoly on power. In the absence of that ideology, it has turned to nationalism. So it has turned to promoting a story where it is basically guiding the Chinese nation towards the superpower greatness that it lost in the century of humiliation at the hands of various imperialist powers, starting with the Opium War. So from a political perspective, the CCP is concerned with, this is why the CCP is so concerned with its how China and how itself is perceived in an image sense. Like, it is, famously sensitive about sort of any slight real or imagined. So its sort of organizing principle in a political sense is to project an image of power, and an image of basically never being quote unquote bossed around by foreign imperialist powers such as the United States. So like this dynamic also unfolds in the trade talks, right? Like, it's hard for the CCP to be viewed as being delegated terms by the United States, because it impacts its own nationalist legitimacy at home, right? So this focus on nationalism, it plays out in all of these territorial disputes, and it plays out in the naval modernization program, because nothing makes for better propaganda. Nothing makes for a better visual confirmation of the CCP's basically authority to rule China, and its success as the sort of rebirth of Chinese power than these images of the Liaoning sailing the seven seas in a carrier battle group, flying the Chinese flag. Like, these are very powerful symbols, and from a political standpoint, these are the things that are going to continue to drive the military modernization program in China.
And Zach, has the Chinese government given any indication as to what their plan is? How long will they continue to prioritize and focus on naval modernization and expansion? At what point will they stop? Are there other priorities that are competing that they may transition away from naval modernization towards?
I think that at this point, they're not going to stop until they can credibly deny the US Navy access to the area near China so that they can be sure that they could conduct a war against Taiwan without the US Navy intervening, limited military exchange in or around the South China Sea without the US Navy intervening. And like, as I said before, we're not so far off from that, because when Chinese military planners, and I alluded to this before, when Chinese military planners are planning a hypothetical conflict with the United States, they're not looking to defeat the US Navy in totality. They're not thinking about launching an attack on the Western seaboard. They're thinking about creating enough of a cost so that US military planners, the US political leadership, doesn't send the Navy in the first place, right? They're thinking, let's try to make it so that we can undeniably sink a carrier at will, such that the US president will have to think about, is it worth, you know, is that price worth making a point about freedom of transportation in the South China Sea or defending Taiwan, right? So Beijing is basically gambling on the fact that if they can extract sudden and massive costs from the US Navy, that the US Navy will never be sent in the first place. And that strategy is reflective in the fact that you were talking about the qualitative state of the modernization program. Some, like the field where China's made the greatest strides is actually anti-ship missiles, and that's not by mistake. They've been focusing on developing an anti-ship missile that can not be defended against, and that could easily sink a U.S. supercarrier within a certain range. And these missiles are launched from land, right? So the U.S. carriers will be operating close to Chinese shores, and they'll be threatened by these missile platforms launched from the Chinese mainland. And I mean, you know, we don't know the true extent of U.S. military technology at any given time. There's always lots of stuff in development, being tested, etc. But by all accounts, right now, there is no counter to these missiles. And these missiles have already been fielded. These missiles are already part of the Chinese arsenal. So technically, we're almost right now at the point. Well, not even almost. We're probably right now at the point where any intervention by the U.S. Navy in the immediate area surrounding China risks like serious costs for in terms of ships.
And are there any actions that the United States has been taken to attempt to delay or maintain its presence in waters around China?
This is something I'm less aware of. I know that they have been sort of in a broad theoretical sense, they've been transitioning away from asymmetric warfare of counterterrorism and more to war with a peer competitor, sort of in the same vein as the Cold War. However, like I said before, there's no way right now to deal with these anti-ship quote-unquote carrier killers. I'm sure that they're looking for a technological solution. I read a report or two that suggested that they are part of the reason why they canceled the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia was because they want to develop their own missile counter and then sort of deploy these missiles in and around China so that they could at least take a crack at removing at least some of these missile sites before that they would be able to launch at the carriers. So they would be able to launch a preemptive strike at the missile batteries. But that's all hypothetical. At this point, I don't know what. There's not many options available. And if you go look at the reports, if you look at the congressional reports, you'll get, you'll get all sorts of grim quotes like, the game has already changed and stuff like that. Like this, it's not a problem that can easily...
Well, in that scenario, from either side, it'd be a very aggressive act, either the U.S. attacking the missiles or China launching a missile that would sink a U.S. ship. So another interesting question is, what would the willingness of either side be to escalate things to that extent at the very beginning of any U.S. intervention?
Again, this is my personal opinion, but I don't think the South China Sea would be it. I think the South China Sea would be, at most, you'd have a very limited exchange that could probably be ultimately... have the crisis be sort of resolved by diplomatic means. It's similar to the way the Kashmir crisis unfolded, where you have a sudden incident, but cooler heads prevail and it doesn't spin into something bigger. Because you're right, like talking about these hypothetical situations, it's an extreme situation. Like it's nothing we've seen for a long time, right? Like and it should be stressed that this is purely hypothetical and incredibly unlikely. However, I do think that Taiwan, as is, Taiwan definitely has the potential to create these kind of worst case scenario contingencies because of the complexity and intractable nature of the problem.
Fascinating. And
that is just briefly, we can talk about this. We can talk about Taiwan in the future. Obviously, Taiwan is something that I'm, very familiar with. I've lived in Taiwan for a long time. And I studied Taiwan in school for many years. So something I know a lot about. For people who don't know, basically, Taiwan is a self-governing island claimed by China. And America, by law, is required to defend it. The Chinese strategy towards Taiwan has been to increase its own capabilities, and to the point where, as we were talking about before, they make the calculation that the U.S. Navy would be unwilling to assist Taiwan, and China would be able to militarily invade it if it came to that.
Interesting. Well, that will be a good topic for a future podcast, getting into the details of Taiwan and its relations with China in the region. So, Zach,
that'd be a long one.
Is there anything else on China's naval modernization and expansion that you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Nothing really. I mean, like, it's definitely something to keep track of. And also, I didn't get into the specifics of the different platforms that are rolling out and the specifics of fleet composition, because I think that makes for a better infographic or just better an article than a podcast. But all the information's out there, and we have a good article on it on the Geopolitical Monitor, so you can check that out. And it's a subject that I'm sure we're going to return to in the future.
And to our listeners, you can check out our website at geopoliticalmonitor.com, including the article Backgrounder, China's PLA Navy Modernization. So thanks so much, Zach. It's been very informative. And thank you to our listeners. And looking forward to next time. See you then.